Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still.
Be.
Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Still and know, be still, be.
I'm Michael Dean. I'm a member of the Word and Life Steering Committee. It's my pleasure to be the MC today. Welcome to week 6 of Word and Life's fall series based around Cynthia Bourgeol's book, The Wisdom Way of Knowing. Today's chapter we're focusing on is chapter 6, titled Freedom and Surrender. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker of today, John Draper. And I see where Judith, along with the Zoom link, sent out John's bio. So you can read much more about John on that link, or we post all of the bios of our speakers on our website, wordandlife.us, and you can read the bios of all our speakers for the entire series. I have had the privilege of knowing John for a number of years now. As through our men's group at Trinity Episcopal Church, the men's retreat, and most recently in his capacity as the deacon at our church. We could not have anyone better to reflect on today's chapter than John, for whom surrender has been, in my experience with him, a central theme in his personal life, his spiritual journey, which includes attending Richard Rohr's Living School, as well as his study for being ordinated as a deacon, and his work as a hospital chaplain. I have often heard him share his thoughts on this subject in personal conversation, in group discussions, and most recently from the pulpit. So I greatly appreciate him being here today to share with the entire Word and Life community. So Tim, if you would lead us in the blessing of John as he begins, that would be great.
We bless you as you share your gift of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
All right, John, take it away.
Amen. Wow. What a pleasure, what a privilege to be with all of you today. This journey that we've been on together has just been absolutely remarkable, and I've been so pleased to have the space and the time to spend the journey with you. I think one of the reasons that I've joined you for every session, quite frankly, my good friends, is it's such a treat to be with other people who are willing to be on this same journey. Several months ago, as Michael already mentioned this, but when I was invited by all of you, the Word and Life Committee, to pick a chapter, to no surprise to my friend Michael and my friend Marianne Evans, they all suspected, and they were not disappointed, that I picked chapter 6. Because quite frankly, surrender for the last 26 years of my life has been something of a mantra. And it's kind of my word. It might even be one of my names that God has given me, that he wanted to show me the importance of surrender. And being on this journey with you is so sweet, because I remember one time at one of the men's retreats with Mark Benson, we were giving them an overview, the men an overview of centering prayer. And one of the participants asked the question, well, why do you meditate every day? And without even missing a beat, what popped into my mind, which we've been reading about in Cynthia's book here, I said, it's the way I can die before I die. And this person, basically, to echo the words of the acorns in acornology, said, I don't want to think about dying before I die. And yeah, I went to myself, well, John, those were dumb words to use, because I just figured that everybody would be on the same page with me. So part of my surrender is learning that everybody's not on my page, certainly not on my filter, which is unique to me, just as your filter is unique to you. But I will tell you that being with you on that journey has just been a real treat for me. 26 years ago, before I heard about Cynthia or Richard Rohr or Jim Finley, and long before I heard about A Living School in a Moment of Clarity, I recognized that one drink was too many and a million was not enough. And I'm sure that we all know, with some of the aha moments that we've received during our journey, is that there's good news and bad news about clarity. The good news is, as each new opportunity to learn and grow unfolds, I find a freedom to be with the one in whom I live and move and have my being. The bad news, which is actually also good news, I can never go back to the old emotional band-aids that left me lost in a sea of alcohol and, to quote an old phrase, looking for love in all the wrong places. To go back would be to lose my life by trying to protect the ego self that we all know is actually an illusion. But thanks to sobriety, one day at a time, and the discipline of meditation, one day at a time, I now know that the willingness to die before I die is actually the pathway to peace. Cynthia has helped me immeasurably to connect with what I've somehow known to be true for 26 years. When I was at the Living School, I used to joke that Father Richard helped me to organize my left brain theological perspective, which is what we use when we're talking about, trying to talk about what we're experiencing. Jim Finley, he spoke directly to my heart. Every time he started talking, I'd start crying. There was just a connection there. But Cynthia, I'd like to say, gave my right permission, my right brain permission to talk to my left brain and actually be heard a little bit. I believe it was in the Living School that I heard the quote attributed to the Buddha, that the pointing finger is what guides us to the moon, but it is only useful because it helps you to see the moon for yourself, which is why the Buddha also warned us not to mistake the finger for the moon. So many of Cynthia's books have been important guides for me, important pointing fingers for me. But he made the point, he warned us not to mistake the finger for the moon. They are only fingers pointing at the what Cynthia calls the alchemy of transformation, which is my experience of what the wisdom way of knowing is talking about. Folks, I spent most of my life living in my mind, trying to come up with all the right answers, trying to be smarter than the next guy or gal. You know, a little vulnerable moment here with you, trying to be like God, hello. Knowing good from evil and, quite frankly, dabbling in both. Trying to find a fulfillment in individual wellness and success as I polished my acorn shell. Always those efforts failed to satisfy what was deepest inside of me. I knew all about the theology of grace. I could debate with you Ephesians 2, 8, and 9 until the cows come home at night. But I never actually experienced it until that evening on June 11th, 1996, when God lifted the compulsion to take the first drink, simply because, for no other reason, for no altruistic effort on my part, simply because I had no place else to go. I had no place else to go. And basically, I've never looked back except to say, I want you to hear me on this. I'm always surprised when I realize that in order to recognize the next indicated step of surrender, I have to embrace all over again the existential reality that in that moment, I have no place else to go. Isn't that crazy? I don't know why it's that way, folks. I don't know why it's that way, folks. Cynthia talks about it a lot, but what I've come to accept is that that's the way it works. I have to remember in the moment of surrender that I have no place else to go. So what Cynthia calls synchronicity, which she talks about being a great byproduct of surrender, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the chapter. What our friend Dave Rico calls transcendent grace. And they tell about it beautifully, which leads me to believe that they have experienced it for themselves. And that's what they're trying to do, is point at this thing called surrender, which is not the same as experiencing grace for myself. Experiencing grace for myself, experiencing surrender for myself is what's changing my life. And hanging out with you folks and being a part of our small group discussions, clearly it's something that's also changing yours. So as we take a walk through chapter 6, and let's be mindful of how we've actually experienced what Cynthia is talking about in this chapter. For those of you that were able to take a peek at the little summary that I sent you, because I don't want you trying so hard to write Cynthia. I'm sorry, Judith. I mistook you for Cynthia Bourgeau there for a second. Please forgive me. What Judith sent you is a little summary of the chapter, and hopefully it'll help you to kind of stay in track with me as I ramble on for the next few minutes. But what I had to notice, which is right at the top of that outline, is that in order to explain what she means by surrender and freedom and something called genuine collectivity, which is not even in the title of the chapter, she uses 5 stories to get there, and maybe there's more, but I counted 5 stories. And those 5 stories are, she opens the chapter with a reference to the Rhinestone Cowgirls in Aspen, and how, oops, they all noticed that, in fact, they were peas in a pod. They all had the same outfit on. She references Freud, who elevated good news, bad news kind of a thing to kind of a worldview almost that psychology is really all about the ego, which those of us on this journey of dying before we die know that's really all about letting go of the ego self, or what Merton called the false self. She's got a story about Hank, larger than life Hank. We've all had those people in our lives, have we not? Who come to the end of their lives trying to keep on, no, I'm not going to give in, I'm not going to give in. I see this a lot in Cottage Hospital when I'm with folks that are coming to the end of their lives. They just don't want to give in until they do. And then Hank asking Cynthia in that moment, are you fearless yet? Are you fearless yet? And Cynthia admitting, no, I'm not, but I'm trying. And that's really what we're talking about when we talk about surrender, is falling fearlessly into love. We've got Tibet, which is, we'll talk about that a little bit, is that instead of being overwhelmed by the threat of the guard to shoot him, the Tibetan monk says, no, I give you permission to take my life. And then we've got Sharon, who in a moment of car failure experienced a wonderful moment of being present and noticing life happening all around her, and barely noticed the synchronicity of a tow truck showing up just in that moment. We've got the one parable, acornology, which for me in a lot of ways, and at Trinity, I had fun with it a few weeks ago, had a little acorn for everybody, and it's really the backbone, I think, of this chapter. And then we've got four metaphors. We've got the candle, which is a metaphor for the outer life. This is just the tallow and the wick, but it's the inner life that is all about flame. We've got reciprocal feeding, which Cynthia refers to as psychic force, mentioning the Gregorian chants that were discontinued in a monastery in France. And within a couple few months, people started losing energy, a will to live. And the abbot, as I recall the story, recognized, I better bring Gregorian chant back, because somehow it has a sustaining energetic quality to it. And then my supervisor at Cottage Hospital, who I did most of my clinical pastoral education with, at one point cracked me up when she was referring to the force be with you, the Luke moment. And she said, you know, my theology has included the fact that it looks like George Lucas might have gotten it right after all. And there's some interesting truth in that. And then finally, the metaphor of the rainbow, which we'll talk about a little bit too, which has had such a huge impact on my life. So when Cynthia talks about surrender, she says, that's exactly what wisdom does, and in fact, all the great spiritual traditions of the world do, without exception. They recognize that the I, whom I take to be myself, moves about on the planet making choices and doing her thing, is not who I am at all. It's only an acorn, and coiled within that acorn is a vastly more majestic destiny. And it can only become an oak tree if it lets go of its acorn. So that's a part of the experience that we're talking about. Dawn, my wife, and I happen to live under a majestic oak tree that surrounds our bedroom. And it feels like living in a treehouse ever since I read this parable, I look at that oak tree with new wonderment, wondering, really? Am I really going to be that someday? To what extent am I becoming that oak tree right now? Am I really becoming something new today? Her definition of surrender and the gesture it refers to is on page 72. You have it there in your notes. The real dying is much more an inner attitude, more of a just let the fear come up and fall through to the other side. What came out of Cynthia's mouth when she was visiting with her friend Hank at the stage when he was digging in and fighting the circumstances of his cancer, and somehow, much to her regret, perhaps, that she had shared those words with him, that just let the fear come up and fall through to the other side, it ultimately helped Hank to embrace what was inevitable. And so that's the gesture that surrender refers to. And she refers to it at the end of Tim's overview of chapter 5 last week, which I am so grateful for, Tim. The richness that you pulled out of that just really kind of short chapter was just amazing and meaningful to me in so many ways. The code word for this inner gesture is surrender. In the wisdom lexicon, Cynthia Rice, it specifically denotes the passage from the smaller acorn self into the greater oak tree self, brought about through this act of letting go. It means to hand oneself over, to entrust oneself to something or someone. And for me, the mystery of the one in whom I live and move and have my being is what I try to surrender to. It's not about an outer capitulation, but about an inner opening. It's always voluntary. And rather than an act of weakness, it's always an act of strength. But as I said earlier, my caveat, my personal caveat, is that I always, in the moment of a new step of surrender, have to embrace the fact that I have no place else to go. That's my truth. She uses that Buddhist story to illustrate what surrender feels like. The monk in Tibet, soldier bursts into his monastery cell, threatening to kill him. And you don't understand, I have the power to take your life. And the monk opens his eyes briefly and smiles sweetly at the soldier. No, it's you who doesn't understand. I have the power to let you. Now, in that context, the example that I wanted to give you is that my experience of dying happened at one point, obviously, when I gave up the need, the desire, the perceived need and the desire to drink. I was on my way down to my first unit of clinical pastoral education at Good Sam Hospital down in LA. And taking my first unit of CPE only because I wanted to be ordained as a deacon in the Episcopal Church, my new church home. I'm one of the recovering evangelicals that's found their way into the Episcopal Church. And so I thought that being a chaplain was all about praying with people, was all about listening to what their problems were and offering them a solution, was all about fixing whatever they had. And by fixing them, what was I doing? I was stroking my own ego, right? And come to find out, in sales terminology, a lot of being a chaplain is cold calling. It's knocking gently on a door and walking in without any agenda to fix or to make feel better or to pray. It's none of that. I'm riding down on my motorcycle. That's how I get around town and pretty much around everywhere, is I'm on a motorcycle. And the idea that I was going down on a weekend to spend my whole weekend cold calling on patients frightened me to the point that it almost froze me, and I almost didn't go, and I almost decided I can't do this. It was a huge moment of fear. But somehow, my nickname for the Holy Spirit is Sophia, as I'm traveling down on my motorcycle, she whispers in my ear, "This is just something we're going to do together, John." And I have to tell you, it was a dying moment. I had no place else to go. And 4 years later, I walk into patient rooms with a freedom and a curiosity and just a delight that I get to be with these people in these moments. Even when Sophia uses me in a very unexpected way. Recently, a mom and a dad were saying goodbye to their 33-year-old son in the ICU at Cottage. And we all can imagine how devastating, those of us that have kids, how devastating that would be. Children are supposed to die before their parents. And I walked into the room, and within 5 minutes or so, I could tell that the mom didn't feel comfortable with me. Little did I know that she felt very uncomfortable with me. And she asked her husband, whispered to him, and asked him to ask me to leave the room. My ego was devastated, but I smiled at them. I said, "Absolutely, please let me know if there's anything that I can do." And I quietly left the room. And as I left the room, Sophia whispered in my ear, and she said, "John, I needed you to be in that room because that woman who's just struggling with so much grief needed to be angry, pissed off at somebody in this moment to help deal with her pain." And so that's how Sophia used me in that moment. So that's surrender and being used even when we least expected it. With regard to freedom, in the words of that great theologian, Janis Joplin, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Well, kind of, maybe, but it's more than that. In Thomas Merton's words, and you have it there on your outline, in our culture, freedom almost always means that what Thomas Merton called choice freedom. It's about having the means to do what I want, go where I want, say what I want, buy what I want. What the acorn usually doesn't see is how much these apparently free choices are actually dictated by cultural conditioning and hidden agendas of the lower self with our compulsive wanting and needing. Real freedom does not mean choice freedom, but rather spontaneity freedom. Love that? I love that. Doesn't it feel good to be spontaneous? Merton spoke of a little kernel of gold, which is the essence of you, what we might call the name of God we truly bear, the innermost, most quality of our own aliveness. We'll talk about that some more. Merton observes, the real freedom is to be able to come and go from that center of who we are being called by name and be able to do without anything that is not, and be able to do without anything that is not immediately connected to that center. Because when you die, that is all that is left. When we die, everything is destroyed except for this one thing, which is our God name, our reality, which is the reality that God preserves forever. The freedom that matters is the capacity to be in touch with that center, because it is from that center that everything else moves. So I have a clip for you that I'm going to play. It might start out a little loud on the front end. It's from a movie called Moana. It's a story about a young Hawaiian girl's journey across the sea to find her destiny by returning to the goddess Te Fiti, her lost heart. When it was stolen from Te Fiti, she forgot who she was, the goddess of life, and became a volcanic demon of death and destruction. So in this clip, Moana helps Te Fiti to recover her lost heart. Bear with me for a second, folks. There we go. There we go. Sorry about that. You guys enjoyed that. I love that. It's amazing to me how much wisdom comes out of stories like that. Another word that I wanted to look at in the title is anthropology. And I've got that defined for you there, the science of human beings. But for Cynthia, wisdom anthropology begins with the insight that who we think we are is a cruel or hilarious And I'm not even going to try to pronounce the French because I cannot wrap my tongue around French, never have been able to. But it means that word that you're looking at, well, you're not looking, yeah, you're looking at it in the summary. I'm going to call it trompe-l'oeil. But it's an optical illusion of three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional surface. So it's a perfect metaphor. And it's like those look-alike Aspen women proclaiming themselves individuals. We suffer from a serious case of mistaken identity. This lesser self is not who I am at all. At very most, it is the snake skin. My real I lives far more subtly within it, Cynthia says, captured here and now in the quality of my aliveness. This is most. Perhaps most the most challenging piece of the wisdom understanding, at least to our contemporary worldview. There is a sacrifice involved. The word sacrifice is from the Latin root that means make holy or make whole. We make wholeness by the sacrifice of the lesser self in the holocaust of our becoming. Matthew Wright offered a definition of wisdom from Cynthia back, I think, in the second session that I've been on. It's on his website, St. Gregory's, but I just love it. I haven't been able to find what source it actually came from. I'm pretty sure Judith sent it out to all of us because I sent it to her. It's the quote that wisdom describes a lineage of spiritual knowledge and practice that is principally concerned with transformation. It's not about knowing more. Or as Jim Finley said in one session in the Living School, it's not about strapping your seatbelt tight on your cushion and sailing off into nothingness, only to snap back with new wisdom that you can't wait to share with everybody else. And in the process, let them know that you've arrived and maybe they can too if they listen to what you have to say. It's not that. It's not knowing more. It's knowing more deeply. I love that. And lastly, Cynthia begins the chapter by telling a story that she hopes will help us get a feeling for the difference between phony individualism and what Merton called genuine collectivity. She references the Rhinestone Cowgirls and the Peas in a Pod Society and notices that the most profound fruit of the transformative process is that the individual ceases to be an individual and is transformed instead of into a person. The nuance being that person in the ultimate sense means through whose life greater life resounds. Personare, I guess, means to sound through. And she says, that's what happens to me when I become a string in the concert of God's joy. One of the reasons that finding one's true self is so hard is that the self, the ego self, doesn't exist as an individual. If you can define the boundaries, it's not your true self. The usual religious spin is, I can only find myself, my true self with God. But Cynthia, it resonates with me. She still feels like maybe that's a little bit too dualistic, you know, kind of that me and God, we're a team kind of a thing. It's really living in the one in whom I live and move and have my being. There's an interconnection. That an interconnectivity to life that can't be described. Rather than play a clip for you, maybe I can share it with you later. There's a fellow by the name of Gregory Bateson, who is a well-known anthropologist, cyberneticist, social scientist. One of his daughters did a documentary about his life called An Ecology of Mind. And one of the things that just had an impact on me early on in CPE was that he held up at one point his hand and he said, "What do you see?" And most people would respond, "I see five fingers." But then Bateson does this. He says, "That's not how I see reality." And it turns out that's not how reality works. It's the four relationships. The fact that everything and everyone is interconnected in this web of interrelationship, in this web of the one in whom I live and move and have my being. That's the way reality works. And when I pause, because, I mean, I'm hardwired as a Homo sapien for fear and anxiety, and because I'm hardwired for fear and anxiety, I have a tendency to be constantly worried about taking care of me. That's just the way I'm hardwired. But thank God there's this thing called neuroplasticity, which is recognizing what you and I know being on the journey that we're on, that says, no, we can see things from the perspective of interconnectivity. And as we see the interconnectivity, we can maybe for a moment, in a reactive moment even, see something different. See what Jesus saw on the cross in my tradition when he said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." There's so much more, but I'm going to quit. The metaphor of the rainbow is so dear to me. I imagined just a few months ago, I dwelt on that, and the rainbow for me has helped me to embrace what heaven might look like. Somehow being a unique color in the panoply of light, prism, and instead of zooming along at 90 miles an hour on my motorcycle, don't tell anybody, I'm zooming along as just a color in the light wave of God at 180 miles an hour, 180,000 miles an hour. I don't know. There's something about that that works for me. I want to mention that one of the metaphors that works for me is the broken heart. 2 days before I was ordained last year, we spent time looking at a Parker Palmer article, recognizing that in order for the heart to open up to the connectivity that we all share and enjoy, the only way for the light to get in is for the heart to be broken open. And what we're going to end with, a broken open heart. I want to leave you with that before I go to this chant. A broken open heart is what makes it possible to fall fearless into love. I heard, you know, that fall fearless into love, that can mean, what does that mean? You know, I asked Tim for a clarification. Love is a tricky word, isn't it? We mean so much by that. But love, Tim defined in a way that I resonate with, that it's a reference to the fact that we're all interconnected. And when you add to that the unique name of God that we each have, it could be freedom, it could be forgiveness, it could be kindness, it could be faithfulness, it could be gentleness, it could be one of those things. And so let's just listen to a little bit of this fall fearless into love And then I'm going to turn it back to Tim. Thank you, you guys. I don't have a nice screen for this, but I'm just going to play it for you. Thanks so much. Tim, back to you.
John, I've pasted the questions in the chat. Would you like to read them and invite us to conversation today?
Certainly. So share a moment when you let go of your acorn self and gave yourself permission to fall fearlessly into love. And how did that moment manifest itself? Or have you had a moment where you had no place else to go? Moments in your life when you embraced the serenity to accept the things you cannot change. And number three, what is one of God's names for you? Is it love? Is it compassion? Is it strength? Is it steadfastness, mercy, truth, justice, patience, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, or maybe just one of the colors of the rainbow? Pick one of those if you get a chance and share something about that.
Thanks, John.
And
all right,
Tim,
y'all.
Yeah. We'd like to remind people that if you do not go to a breakout room, be sure to stay with us, because we have a wonderful discussion afterwards that is not recorded. So don't miss out on the conversation after the breakout rooms. Thank you.